Thank you for tuning in. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Friday, September the 14th, 2012, day 5 of the teachers' strike in Chicago, and significant progress is reported at the bargaining table. You will recall that 30,000 teachers and support personnel walked off of their jobs on Monday after months of negotiations with the city failed to produce a new contract. Chicago's school district, with about 400,000 students, is the third largest in the country. Stacey Davis Gates is the legislative and political director of the Chicago Teachers Union. She joins us now with a brief update. Stacey, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Right now, we are anticipating a meeting with our House of Delegates at 2 p.m. Central Standard Time to update them on contract negotiations to feel the pulse of our membership. One thing about this union is that we are rank and file driven, so our members have a tremendous amount of power, and our leadership wants to make sure that we are in sync with the developments and, you know, they understand fully what's going on at the table.
Will the meeting be for the purpose of presenting an agreement for ratification or just to update the union membership on where things stand right now with negotiations?
As it stands currently, we are just going in for an update. We've been on the line for 5 days, and our members need to understand and hear it directly from our leadership, the progress that has been made at the table.
Union President Karen Lewis has said that there has been a great deal of progress made. What was the turning point?
I think tens of thousands of people in downtown Chicago. Certainly those optics, that energy here in the city had to, you know, challenge the city's direction in this process. We've been negotiating since November 2011. Well, we've been negotiating since November 2011. I think that the city had been trying to either ram their proposals down our throat or talk us out of striking. So either way, we needed another party in order to negotiate. And when our membership, when our parents in the city and when our students in the city stood up and said with us in unison, enough is enough, we finally were able to get some quality negotiations.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson was seen in the midst of it all, ostensibly to broker some kind of an agreement or to hasten one along. Did he play or has he played a major role in this so far?
I think his mere presence in this situation has challenged our city's leadership to pay attention in a more specific manner to what's going on. I mean, Reverend Jackson had never attended a Chicago Board of Education meeting until this year. He heard that there were 160 schools, 140 of those schools on the south and west sides of Chicago without libraries. He termed that educational apartheid, and he's made a firm commitment to working with the educational system here to make sure that no matter what zip code you live in, that, you know, students are afforded a quality education.
Okay, so let's kind of recap. What would you say? You described yesterday that there were monetary issues, which is, of course, the wage increase, and you said those issues actually were dispatched with quite early in the bargaining process. But the non-monetary issues, you said, were the main sticking points.
Well,
are they still the main sticking points even at this time?
Well, I think that they're making progress on all of the above. Now, in terms of what that will look like, you know, when there is a conclusion that, you know, our leadership and our rank and file thinks is worthy enough of ratification, we're hopeful. You know, it's been 5 days. our teachers, our clinicians, our social workers, our counselors, our PSRPs want to get back into the buildings with their students. You know, this is a hardship for them in two different ways. I mean, they're on the picket line and they're foregoing a paycheck as well. They have children as well in the system too. And so not only are they having to understand how to, you know, recalibrate their own daily schedules, they're also taking in some financial hardship as well. So, you know, understand that when the mayor talks about, when Mayor Emanuel talks about that this is a strike of choice, you know, that's one of the most insulting things that we've heard so far. This is certainly not a strike of choice. This has been we've been backed into a corner, you know, and have been backed into this corner, you know, for the last couple of years. I think that his tone and lack of respect for those who do the work in the city has exacerbated the situation profoundly, and that our, you know, it's enough is enough. I mean, that's just what this basically boils down to. And we know that this system is going to be radically challenged in the next couple of months with school closings, where they are proposing to close up to 100 schools. And what happens to the city of Chicago when its public schools are under siege and the most vulnerable communities are being taken advantage of?
Well, you are the legislative and political director, so I'm going to ask you a legislative and political question. What,
sure,
at this point, even at this point when so much progress reportedly has been made, what is the make or break we're walking away from the table issue?
You know, I'm going to just say that there's progress right now. And
because you give me a nice diplomatic answer here.
Well, because there's progress right now, and we are very hopeful for that progress. You know, this has been very difficult for us to even deal with. I mean, you know, no one wants to walk away from their classroom. So that's just how terrible of an experience that this has been for us, is because, you know, this is the ultimate. This is the ultimate card to play as a union, and even more so as teachers. This is the ultimate card. So we're just remaining hopeful. We are remaining optimistic. We are, but we're still resolute, and we're still strong and unified and in solidarity with these actions. Just today, FEIU, our brothers and sisters in the school who are represented, our brothers and sisters in the school, the security guards and the custodial staff joined our picket, and they were sick of crossing the line. They were intensely sick of crossing the line, and so they're standing with us today. We also, through some polling, have found out that 65% of our parents on the African American side, 63% of our parents on the Latino side, are Black and Brown students who are being impacted by this more intensely. Their families are standing with us, and that is something that we know. This entire narrative of the bad teacher or the disconnected teacher is so completely disconnected from reality. Anytime you have your child, you send me your child every single day, Monday through Friday, we form bonds with families. They trust us. They believe us. They see how hard we work with their children, and that means a lot to us. And we would not breach that relationship for anything that wasn't as serious as it is here in Chicago.
The projection is that something of an agreement might be reached next week, early next week. I don't know, and of course, nobody quite knows yet whether that would in fact happen. But assuming that it does, and there's an agreement, and people go back to the classroom, there is work to be done. What does the union see as the immediate task? I mean, apart from getting back to normal and going back to school and teaching and so forth, what, from the union's perspective, an organizational point of view, is the union's immediate task right after an agreement is reached?
Well, we've always been very clear that this contract is just but one battle and a long line of battles that we will be a part of with this particular administration. We're clear that the loss of schools on the south and west side of Chicago would be absolutely detrimental to the city. And we're willing to stand in lockstep with our parents and our community partners in trying to prevent that. So I would say very clearly that that's going to be an issue. We know that charter school advocates are attempting to raise the cap in the state of Illinois to build more to expand the charter school. We are very, we're very critical of that. We want to maintain quality. You know, that's one thing that's been talked about a lot with this fight that we are in right now, is that that the mayor wants quality. Well, we challenge the mayor. If you want quality, you should want quality with every school in the city of Chicago. So we see the charter school expansion as certainly something that we will have to contend with. We see this continued assault by private interest on public resources as a fight that we will be continuing. We see this whole narrative of public educators and public education as something that we're attempting to turn upside down. One of the byproducts, one of the more positive byproducts of the strike is the fact that the entire nation is now tuned in at some level on this school reform agenda. We call it a school deform agenda because it's not an agenda that has listened to the experts or has attempted to collaborate in any meaningful way with the experts, which is the teacher in the classroom, quite frankly, on how this should work. No one at our level seems to think that status quo works, but certainly this ushering in of this private agenda has proven already not to work. 1 in 6 of the charter schools work, even with the measures that they draw to try and hedge their bets in getting the best type of student, they still are neck and neck with the neighborhood schools in Chicago that take all students, no matter what, in their attendance boundary. So we really and truly have to begin speaking the authentic truth about school reform. We have to start challenging the general public on this. You know, there's not an education crisis in America. We don't have these same discussions about schools in our suburban or our more affluent areas in America. We're only having these discussions about areas in our country that have been plagued by high unemployment rates, high poverty rates, a disinvestment in the manufacturing industries, the industrial industries. And I get we're moving in more of a technological direction here in our country, but at the same time, we're moving away from our most vulnerable populations and making sure that these people have a portal for success. We know that only 25% of the students that live in a neighborhood, when the charter school is the only option, go there. So you have students, you know, traveling a great distance to even go to school here in Chicago, and that's profoundly an issue, and this is a societal issue. I think one of the symptoms of, you know, this thing we've been dealing with called poverty is the fact that our children are being our children are being marginalized even more so. Their families are being placed in a position of having to make very unfair choices about the type of education that their students deserve. We don't even have an elected representative school board in Chicago, which makes it awesomely more difficult to advocate for your child, because the people who sit on the board are appointed by the mayor, and we know that these people have a great flexibility in their lives because they've been afforded that through a great education, because they make a reasonable amount of money, or even a more, or they're wealthy. So it makes it, there's a disconnection. There's a disconnection in what the everyday parent is dealing with here, and what the reality of many of our board members deal with. And this is not an indictment on success. This is a, I think, a more authentic narrative on how we need to properly engage and then collaborate and then implement the types of policy changes that will honor and respect the voice of those who need public education the most.
Stacey Davis Gates, thanks so much for joining us today and giving us this briefing. Of course, I did say to you, I would like, once this is over, at least in the immediate aftermath of it, to return here, because this is a very profound story unfolding in Chicago that has, as you did correctly say, national, if not international, implications with respect to the delivery of educational services to distressed communities. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us. I appreciate it.
All right. Well, I want to give a lot of time to you. We haven't talked a bit this week. We've been talking with guests and so forth, but today, you are the guest. We'll start taking calls very shortly at 1-888-874-4888. But when we come back after this break, I want to share with you some thoughts about the violence unfolding in the Middle East. We'll come back right after this. Listening to the great Miles Davis, and that is titled So What. It's one of my favorite pieces. You might have gathered by now that I'm a serious jazz fan. Actually, I like all kinds of music, but jazz is a particular favorite of mine. You no doubt are following the events as they unfold in what they call the Middle East. I don't know middle of what, east of where. That's a whole other subject. That's a whole other subject that deals with how power can arbitrarily decide anything, including geography, and perhaps especially geography. I give you the case of the what they call Indians in the United States, the First Nations people who are called Indians. No relationship whatsoever geographically to India, but that's the name that has stuck for all these years. But I digress. In the immediate situation, our minds and our eyes and our focus are all trained to ask one question. What is it about the folks that they're so out of control? And why can't the president himself ask a question? Why can't you control your people, of these leaders of countries like Libya and Egypt, Tunisia? And now they, like a cancer, this violence, this revolt is spreading quickly all over a really interesting thing. Some obscure... What's the word? I mean, third rate is actually a compliment for this so-called filmmaker who makes a film that denigrates a religion and a main prophet of this religion. These things are very, very, very serious to people. And it triggers a tremendous outpouring of fury. Of course, you know it claimed the lives of four people in the diplomatic service, including the U.S. ambassador to Libya and some embassy workers there, three others. And the momentum is picking up all throughout the Muslim world. Anti-Western sentiment, and more specifically, anti-U.S. sentiment. But even now, as we return to this theme once again, we still have the same mind-boggling reaction from official circles in the United States at the highest level, including the president and the secretary of state on down. The question is, why can't these folks contain themselves? Well, the question we should be asking is the question we asked on right here, Rory O'Connor, who did that marvelous documentary, 911 Press for Change, talked about the importance of paying attention to some things that are just out of whack. This film had been around for a while. In fact, the guy who made this film, who is a pretty, turns out to be quite shady, many questions being asked about him. He lied about his identity, lied about the source of the money that he got to make this film, lied even about who is supporting it, and so forth. But the film has been around. And he, as part of a conviction that he had in California for kiting checks, was actually prohibited from using computers and the internet as part of his sentence. Now, in this day and age where we understand the reconfiguration of the world and the reconfiguration of the power equation in this world, where we should have a serious appreciation for how things, the chain events that could occur to our ruin, actually, when we as a country don't do what we are supposed to do. We are supposed to be in a heightened state of alert by now. We're supposed to appreciate the relationship between these acts of provocation and the consequences. And we are supposed, 911, that was the whole point. When you have the information, you do nothing about it. It grows to this stage where one guy with a kind of third-rate, obscure, silly movie production can now cause this entire country and other countries in the world to arrive at a point literally of war. And you're supposed to have an intelligence system. You're supposed to be placing people on the terror watch list. This guy was supported by that pastor in Florida, the Let's Burn Korans pastor, what's his name, Terry Jones, that should have sent up a red flag right away. Supposedly you're watching these people. These are hate crimes in the United States. You're supposed to have some kind of domestic surveillance of people, and things are supposed to trigger an alarm within the intelligence community, not to say that they're busting people's chops, but because at this point, as a country, you ought to appreciate that there could be dire consequences for ignoring things that would pull us in that direction. But instead, our Secretary of State and our president, and I understand, I appreciate it is correct for them to insist that U.S. citizens and U.S. diplomatic missions abroad be protected, and that the heads of state of those countries should do everything possible to secure the safety of American citizens. And that is correct. That's the way it ought to be. But the internal conversation in the United States is what needs to be had. How do we reach a point, and this is not the first time, how do we reach a point over and over again, and it does not inform any administration? It doesn't matter whether it's Republican or Democrat. It certainly didn't inform George Bush, and we had 9/11. We have had people dying because logical steps simply are not being taken. And we have to ask the question, well, wait a minute. Didn't somebody see that this could be potentially dangerous and do something about it? So the question we have to deal with, and I'd like you to chime in what your views are, is what do we do as a nation when the act of one individual can actually propel the nation into a state of war? And look how much money already has been spent. Heightened security, and people have to travel to these countries, and negotiations are occurring, and all this kind of stuff, and the military is being readied, and all of this because one nut job can make a film that clearly was a deliberate act. We still don't know who this man is affiliated with. We still don't know what the actual hidden hand might be behind this whole thing, this act of provocation. And that's the question. The second question is this. To this point, I have not heard any official discussion as to what is going to be a policy in the United States about this issue. Because now, you know, even with all of this, the U.S. is still maintaining what I believe to be an arrogant position. You know, it's like we, quote unquote, somebody from the U.S. does something really stupid. And now the whole country has to scramble to protect its interests and to protect the entire nation because of one person. Well, don't hide behind First Amendment rights. But that's what it says. And that is what it's saying to the people outside of the U.S., the people who are affected. That even with this heavy weight against you, you're still maintaining the view that this notion of First Amendment rights dominates the national good. It trumps it. This guy, and Hillary Clinton says, yes, well, you know, she detests the film and she, you know, she excoriates it in the most outrageous terms. She says this is a horrible thing to have happened. But the inference still is that this guy was right as an American to exercise his First Amendment rights. And that's where I think we need to be real clear and less disingenuous about this thing, because we know that there are no rights, none. There are no rights at all in the United States that are absolute. All rights are conditional, even the right to life itself. I could be walking down the street and minding my own business, and if I am deemed a threat to a police officer, he can shoot and kill me right there on the spot, in that he has more rights to my life than I do. So let's not pretend that there's this absolutism about the First Amendment. The question is, when it squares against the national interest, as it does here, what is our position? This is not the first time we have come to this point. What is our position? That's the question. That's the question. 1-888-874-4888. The media right now, I'm watching CNN and watching different reports of how they're covering this event, and it falls into the same pattern. Look at the people violating American rights. Look at them rioting in the streets. Look at them causing all this heartache. And in fact, the last report I saw, the reporter was in Egypt and said, happily, no one has been killed yet. You know, it's like a sport. The point is to ask these questions. Why is it that our intelligence, internal security, is failing? This thing should have been picked up a long time ago. And why are we, even at this point, thinking that an American, quote-unquote, even though the guy initially had said that he was an Israeli-American having dual citizenship, until the Israeli government said they have no record of him as an Israeli citizen. But what is it that we can't get? What has to happen for us to get the point that it is imperative because the world has changed, the power equation has shifted and has changed dramatically. Now, you could stand on high moral ground all you want and boast about your superior military might, but here we are. One person has put this entire country in a state of distress right this minute. And hundreds of millions of dollars already are going to be spent and allocated to secure the United States because one person has exercised what is seen as his First Amendment rights to free speech. Okay. Okay. That's the question. How did we get here? And why don't we recognize that that's an issue? So that while, yes, the U.S. is correct to demand that governments where we have embassies and we have diplomatic stations secure, that's international convention, to secure the premises and the safety of the people working in these diplomatic stations. But the leaders of those countries also have a right to ask, well, wait a minute, what are you guys doing? You know that there's a relationship between this kind of behavior and the dire consequences it has produced. This is not new. We've gone through several cycles of this. So don't you have some way of, you know, spotting a red flag and doing something about it before it becomes a problem, especially now? Do we need this kind of headache? Do we need one person to put the entire country in a state, literally, of war, almost? Because if something else were to happen, you know there's going to be military intervention. And even if there is no military intervention, there is military mobilization for possible intervention. Come on. We have to be grown up. This is the question. This is the question. On a cultural level, I think Gary touched on that, we too have to understand, whatever it is you think, you have to understand that there are people all around the world, just as we do, there are certain things we hold sacred. And that's a fact. There are certain things all over the world that people hold sacred. And to them, to us, and to others, these may be negotiable items. To a large segment of the world, there are certain things that are absolutely non-negotiable items. And whether you agree or whether you approve is of no consequence. If you are intelligent in this reconfigured world, this politically reconfigured world, this reconfigured political reality that we're in, that should inform our conduct. And time and again, we get into trouble as a country because we seem to have no appreciation that other people think very differently and are prepared to defend what they believe to be their right to their beliefs. They have non-negotiable items. It doesn't look pretty. It isn't good. It may not even be right. But it is a fact. And what I'm saying is, we're supposed to be sophisticated as a country. We're supposed to have an understanding of the relationship between cause and effect, action and consequence. And the question that seems pertinent at this point is, what has happened, or what did happen here? Because this thing has been around, floating around the internet for a while. If we in fact have a well-functioning internal security system that is supposed to notice red flags, how come they didn't notice this? We'll be right back with your calls, 1-888-874-4888. We'll take a few messages from our other programs right here on the Progressive Radio Network. You're listening to Lead Stories. We have Gene from New Hampshire, I believe. He's with us. Thank you, Gene, for joining us today.
It's a she.
Oh, it's a she. Yes. Thank you. Sorry. I saw it spelled with a G.
So. No. J-E-A-N.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to say, I wanted to say something and ask you a question. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to say is the reaction of both Obama and the Romney camp. The Romney camp was scarier, but Obama's was quite unpleasant also, in the terms of immediately going to the accusatory rather than the sympathetic. And I want to know from you, why can't he just say what you just said? Why can't he stand in front of the world and say exactly what you just said? And you know, it would quell everything. I don't get it.
Well, I have news for you. It will not quell everything. This is political season. The big prize is the presidency. The current president, the incumbent president, has already been accused of being soft on the so-called Middle East and on the Islamists. And so he's got a stake here to act as the strong head of state to counter the accusations of the opposition, and also to convey to the nation that he's a strong leader. You have to understand that this is actually an embarrassment. This is an embarrassment. And to openly admit it, to say that we have a failed system here, this thing points to a failed internal system, that would not score good points for him at the polls this year. So that is, in an ideal world, he should come forward and actually admit, but that's not the way politics works. But what I'm saying is, we need to hear somewhere from some corner of this administration that we have an urgent issue to deal with, and that is, how do we let one person in the United States literally provoke an international incident and put the entire country now at risk of war? Thank you, Gene, for calling. Thanks so much. We have Dave from Brooklyn. Thank you, Dave, for being with us today.
Hi, Utrecht.
Hi.
You know, from listening to you, the logic that I was getting, and it makes sense in a certain way, is that this was not a failure on the United States' part at all. that they were perfectly happy to have this guy make this provocation, whereas on the other side, they stopped free speech all the time. You know, they heard demonstrators, they preemptively arrest demonstrators all the time. So that was the feeling I was getting, the logic of what you were saying, that it wasn't a failure
at all. Actually, what I'm saying is that it's not that I certainly, we don't know what the hidden hands are, if there are any at all in the situation. I'm saying the situation as it is provokes the question, why did our internal security systems, we have gone through 9/11 for crying out loud, and we knew Rory O'Connor was right here telling us since 2006 that the intelligence community fell down on the job big time and then lied about it. Here we have, again, a repeat, and this is not the first repeat. We've had this before, where acts like this, we don't know what informed this. We don't know whether this is some kind of a complex plan by some hidden network of people, or whether, you know, we just don't know. But what we do know is, as it stands, one individual has brought the entire country into a horrible state of potential warfare or military action. This is not right. And we are supposed to have such a good intelligence operation in the United States. The second is, I maintain that the underscoring by this administration, it's typical of U.S. administrations. It's not unique to the Obama administration. It is typical of all U.S. administrations to take the position, which is further aggravating the situation now, that even at this point, the most important thing is the rights of the Americans, including the offender. That's what's more important than anything else.
Well, that's why I thought that the logic of it was that it wasn't an accident, that they may very well have known, but that...
We don't know. Yeah. We don't know. The conspiracy button may have been pressed a couple of times here, but we don't know. We just don't know. What we do know, and what is very clear, is where we stand. And we are also clear that here we are again at a point of serious danger. And by now, having gone through the various experiences this country has had directly, and we have witnessed it outside of the United States and on the international level, we should have had an entirely different response right now. Thank you, Dave, for being with us. Don from New Jersey, thank you for joining us today.
It's good to hear your voice again on the radio.
Thank you, Don.
I was telling your producer that one of the things that is hypocritical of this administration is, on the one hand, you have this director making a movie where he's exercising his right for free speech, and then you have the cleric that the United States, you know, put his military power behind and killed him as an American because he was exercising his speech, and there seems to be some hypocrisy there.
Well, of course, there is hypocrisy, which is why I'm saying that there is no right. There is no right that is absolute.
I agree.
But the spirit of the U.S. official U.S. reaction is that, in fact, there are absolute rights and in the United States, including the Secretary of State is saying, I think this is objectionable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But implicit in her statement is that he is an American, and therefore he somehow, his right, as odious as this film is, his right to produce it is American.
Right. Well, that's why I see the hypocrisy, because, like I said, he has the right to exercise his free speech, but the cleric did not, and he was American, but he was outside the United States, so he was killed for that.
Let me ask you, what would you think should be the position here? and don't cloak it now and say, well, I have to take a left of center view. What does your logic tell you that we should have done?
I think what you stated earlier is that we have to sort of preempt these things, and I think it wouldn't be unusual for the leaders of our country to tell the American people that it's important that we do not produce films or do anything that would provoke other groups around the country to rise up against Americans, no matter where they are. And we have to take a sophisticated, common sense approach, take into consideration that not everybody thinks the way we think or believe what we believe or see the world the way we do, and that we should be sensitive to that and be intelligent.
But let me provoke you a little bit. Wouldn't taking a position like that make you weak in the eyes of the world? You're no longer a superpower. You're buckling to this rabble outside of the United States.
Yes, I think it would be perceived as a weak position, but I think if you really think about it, it's a strong position to take, and I think it's a long-term view, and I think it's a more strategic and important point to make without being weak. You can still be strong and intelligent at the same time.
All right, let me ask you something personal. Let's suppose that you wrote something, and there's a knock on the door, and the people are there from the U.S. Security, the Homeland Security Department, and they say, you know what, Don, we are canceling your right to publish this book. What would you say?
Well, my first instinct would say, why? And if, the explanation was that we think that this book has content in it that might be not in the best interest of our national security or your personal security, and for the time being, perhaps we have to put it on the shelf and release it at another time. I don't think that it would be unreasonable if they thought that it would be a threat to myself or the nation to produce it. I would be open to leaving it on the shelf until such time it was a good time to release it.
But what if you fiercely believed in the integrity of your idea and your right to defend your idea?
Well, I mean, that's the risk that I would have to take. I'm willing to forego my conviction and my belief about the content of my book if it's proven to me that it is of a security issue for the nation and for myself.
So should the government itself have the unilateral right to show up at your door and say, guess what, this book that you just wrote, forget it. It's not being published. We're taking it off the shelf. You may not publish this ever.
In an ideal world, no. But I understand why it would happen. I don't agree with it, but I understand why it would happen.
You don't agree. Okay. Thank you, Don, for joining us. Well,
okay.
you're hearing now how complex this thing is, but it's a necessary wart. It is not pretty. It's like a wart. It's not pretty, but it's there. And how do you deal with this question? Does one individual have the right to bring an entire nation to this state? That's the question at 1-888-874-4888. By the way, if you want to reach me, I am at Lead Stories, LEID Stories, at gmail.com. LeadStories@gmail.com. You see, this is where we need to go. But if you watch the news media today and in any other, several other days, the substance of what we will learn is essentially the outbreak of violence. They would say that this is the story, and then, of course, we ignore the structural problem here and the evidence that something has failed yet again in terms of U.S. national security. You can't have a situation like this because you will have one individual literally having the power to declare war against another country or endangering the United States by his or her unilateral action. Now, the question is, what's the mechanism? Why didn't it work? Why is it failing? Why are we reluctant to see that although other countries are being held responsible. In fact, the president said to Egypt, are you our friend or our enemy? Get your folks together. Get them in line. Putting now other countries, they have now risk whatever their political currency is to maintain friendships with the U.S. This is the ugly trade reaction. It's all started with one guy and a really forgettable, unbelievably bad movie, if you want to call it that. So this is the question. But we won't hear the question. If at all, we'll hear it months later after a commission has been impaneled to ask questions, and then there'll be people who will study the commission's recommendations and another panel to study the commission's panel, and it will go on and on. Here we are in the moment. We are in the danger zone. We are in the moment. And in a flash, we can have an outbreak of war. And it all started with one nut. And we have evidence that our internal systems of security simply did not work. This thing wasn't hiding. It was out there on the internet for so long, for long enough to have come to the attention of our Homeland Security people, our intelligence community. It did not happen. Well, I want to wrap it up here for today, and thank you so much for joining me. I hope you ponder these questions, and as you observe coverage and discussions about this, keep that in mind, that this is a question for us. The question is not about how violence is breaking out. We know that this has been something that has been replayed over and over. What is our responsibility here, and why isn't it working? That's the question. I want to thank you for being with me. Again, to reach me, leadstories@gmail.com. Have yourselves a good and safe weekend, and let's meet each other here again on Monday. And in the meantime, tell everybody you know that 1 o'clock is meeting time right here on the Progressive Radio Network. Thanks. Bye-bye.